what everyone expected would be the biggest that night would likely belong to the candidate riding the most momentum out of Iowa and the biggest wave of enthusiasm. That was Senator Barack Obama, the eloquent newcomer to American politics who had just defeated the frontrunner Hillary Clinton in Iowa and given a victory speech that captured the imaginations of Americans who were tired of politics, including many first-time voters. He appeared unstoppable after Iowa. Everyone assumed he would win New Hampshire, too, and drive Hillary out of the race. I discussed with Davis, Salter, and Schmidt the right message for my speech that night, and we agreed I should begin by saluting Senator Obama's historic achievement and recognize what it meant to his supporters and to the entire country. I would also express my hope that should I be the Republican nominee, our contest would be conducted in a way that would impress Americans in both parties as respectful. That sentiment wasn't only a sincere wish for more civility in politics. The country wanted change. They wanted the biggest change they could get. Barack Obama was offering them change, and he had advantages I did not. He was not a member of the party in power. I was. He was young and cool and new to national politics. I was 71 years old and had been a known commodity for some time with a long record of votes and statements to criticize. He opposed the unpopular war in Iraq. I supported it. He would be the first African American to earn a major party's presidential nomination. He represented change in his very person. I had to convince people I, too, was a change candidate. But the most effective means I had to convey that message was campaigning in ways that might appear novel and authentic to cynical voters. I intended to use my victory speech to start that effort. When it became clear that night that I had managed to come from behind victory, beating Mitt by about 5 points, it was looking like Hillary might be doing the same. When the networks declared me the New Hampshire winner, the Democratic race was still too close to call, and we revised my speech accordingly. I began by noting I was too old to be called any kind of kid, but we sure showed them what a comeback looks like. I thanked the people of New Hampshire for hearing me out even when they disagreed with me. We were down in the polls and written off when we came here, I reminded them, and we had just one strategy, to tell you what I believe. Unable to congratulate the winner of the Democrats' primary, I paid my respect to the supporters of all the candidates, Republicans and Democrats, who worked for a cause they believe is good for the country we all love. We had a long way to go. The Michigan primary was a little more than a week away. Mitt would be hard to beat there. South Carolina would be a close contest between Huckabee, Fred Thompson, and me. I needed to win one of them to continue. Winning both would be preferable, but South Carolina, the place where my rocket ride out of New Hampshire in 2000 crashed, loomed larger. 8 years before, I had stood on the steps of the Bedford, New Hampshire town hall the night before the primary and looked out on a sea of faces. There were people crowding the streets and intersection, extending several blocks. It was thrilling, and I knew I was on the cusp of my biggest political triumph. It remains to this day my favorite campaign memory. My 2008 primary win was not as heady as our victory in 2000, but I was deeply touched by it, and have had ever since a special affection for the proud voters in the first-in-the-nation primary. These people have been so good to us, I told Cindy that night. I owe them so much. The next day, somewhere in Iraq's Anbar province, my son Jimmy helped dig an MRAP, a heavily armored personnel carrier, out of the mud in a wadi that had flooded in a downpour. He was knee-deep in the muck, working a shovel, and sweating in the oppressive heat when his sergeant walked over to him. McCain? Yes, Sergeant. Your dad won New Hampshire.
Did he?
Yeah, keep digging.
Yes, Sergeant.
I laughed when Jimmy recounted the exchange for me, when we were reunited some months later, and I laugh every time I retell it to friends. But as I have remembered it in the years that followed, and remembered, too, my worry then that my ambitions had exposed my youngest son to even greater danger, I moved to tears. Chapter 2. Country First. I received a decent bump in the national polls following my New Hampshire win, and our fundraising picked up, although we still had to pay off the bank loan we borrowed in the summer to keep the campaign running. National polling leads can create a false impression that someone is a front-runner. We don't have national primaries. The next contest was in Michigan on January 15th, and Mitt and I were running neck and neck there. Michigan wasn't do or die for me, but it was for Mitt. Huckabee and I had split the first two contests. Mitt had to get into the picture now or risk being written off by reporters and donors. South Carolina was 4 days after Michigan, and Mitt wasn't competing there. I saw the chance to finish him off and secure a nearly invincible position by winning Michigan and beating Huckabee and Fred Thompson in South Carolina. I had upset George Bush in the 2000 Michigan primary, and I believed I had a good feel for campaigning there. It's obviously a lot more populous and urban than New Hampshire, and I'd spent a lot more time in New Hampshire than we could spend in Michigan. But I felt Michigan voters in 2000 had responded as well as New Hampshire voters had to my candor, which occasionally offered uncomfortable truths to an audience that might disagree. The Straight Talk Express, our boasting motto in 2000, mostly avoided being sanctimonious because now and again I had to pay a real price for it. I would say something in the name of Straight Talk that got me in trouble. We both fought hard for Michigan and threw punches that aggravated our campaign's already healthy game day animosity for the other. I took a shot at Mitt's record on taxes as Massachusetts governor. He accused me of being that most odious of characters, the Washington insider. Most polls had us less than a percentage point apart. Then I offered Michigan voters a little dose of Straight Talk. It was true, but hard to hear, and I have to watch myself and not appear smug when I'm offering a hard truth. I can seem to enjoy being impolitic. Michigan was in the throes of a deep recession and had the highest unemployment in the nation. Technology-driven productivity gains in the automobile industry and foreign competition had cost the state tens, if not hundreds, of thousands of high-wage manufacturing jobs. I campaigned on ideas to help people whose lives were disrupted by the global economy, getting workers into improved retraining programs, and having the government make up some of the difference between the wages they had lost and the lower pay they were now earning in service industry jobs. But I wanted to acknowledge that work was permanently changing in the U.S. in ways that would put a premium on education reform and highly skilled training to achieve the same standard of living that had been common for manufacturing workers in the last century. In a debate, I blurted out that there are some jobs that aren't coming back to Michigan. Mitt jumped on it instantly, grabbing the opportunity to portray me as unsympathetic to dislocated workers and underscore his credentials as a successful businessman who specialized in turning around failing companies. In addition to having been governor of Michigan, Mitt's father, George, had been president of American Motors. "I've got the automobile industry in my veins," Mitt reminded voters, promising to turn Washington inside out to turn Michigan's economy around and accusing me of undue pessimism. It was the smart play. It emphasized his connections to the state and offered voters that most potent of political appeals, hope. I had offered grim reality, which made a negative impression on Michigan voters that overshadowed the policies I proposed to improve it. Mitt won the Michigan primary. It wasn't close, 39-30%. I had missed the chance to land a knockout blow on my most dangerous opponent. Good thing for me, Mitt had effectively abandoned South Carolina. A win there could offset the damage that losing Michigan had done and give me back the advantage going into Florida. I had to beat Mike Huckabee, who was gaining ground in South Carolina with his strength in the upstate evangelical communities. But Mitt's absence in South Carolina wasn't my only piece of good luck. Fred Thompson had decided to stay in the race after losing the first three major contests. He was popular with the base, and he and Huckabee divided voters who were unlikely to support me. My strength was in South Carolina's Low Country, from Myrtle Beach to Charleston to Hilton Head, where social conservatives aren't as prominent as they are upstate. But I had found out in 2000 that I couldn't win the primary with Low Country voters alone, if one opponent won everywhere else. The Associated Press had called the race earlier in the evening when the exit polls and early returns were indicating a 5 or 6 point McCain win. But the wire service had to retract the projection a short while later when the count unexpectedly tightened, my stomach with it. The next couple hours were agonizing. I wanted badly to win South Carolina, not just for the advantage it would give me in upcoming contests, but because South Carolina had been a bitter defeat in 2000. I had something to prove to myself, if no one else. As it turned out, Fred won enough votes to dilute Huckabee's strength, and I did better than expected in the upstate, even winning Greenville, where I'd been clobbered 8 years before. Still, it was a narrow victory, only 3 points, and Huckabee did well enough to be encouraged. He would win quite a few more primaries and caucuses, mostly in the South, before it was over. But I was the recognized frontrunner going into Florida, which was setting up to be the decisive contest. Rudy Giuliani had bet everything on the state. He had mostly avoided Iowa because his positions on abortion and other issues made him unacceptable to social conservatives. He hadn't campaigned much in New Hampshire either, which I thought was a mistake on his part that redounded to my benefit. He's the kind of candidate that appeals to New Hampshire Republicans and independents, outspoken, authentic, and confrontational. He chose to save his resources for a last-stand fight in Florida, where quite a few retired New Yorkers reside. But by then, the press narrative was firmly fixed, and voters were only hearing about a three-person race, McCain, Romney, and Huckabee. I don't think a lot of Floridians even knew Rudy was still running. He and I were friends, and in the days between the South Carolina primary and Florida's, as Rudy sensed his gambit had failed, we stayed on good terms, even hinting that he would encourage his organization and endorsements to support me in the primaries that followed. Mitt had a good organization in Florida and was managing to keep the debate focused on economic issues rather than national security, where I was stronger. He reminded voters that in another burst of straight talk, I had publicly acknowledged I knew less about the economy than national security. He assured them he could do both jobs competently. He hadn't finished taking advantage of my Michigan jobs remark either. I was also on the receiving end of daily attacks from talk radio blowhards. They had some effect, but they aren't as influential as they like their listeners to believe. They make quite a living from promoting polarization in the country and scaring politicians who can only win races in gerrymandered districts. And when they're in high dudgeon, they can be amusing in an over-the-top vaudevillian kind of way. They had been after me episodically for years, pounding my positions on campaign finance reform and immigration and other apostasies. I had learned to laugh it off. They could tie up our front office phones for an hour or so by exhorting their listeners to give the traitor McCain a piece of their mind. But they had a negligible impact on my national popularity. In Florida, their antipathy toward me was frenzied. Even Mitt, the moderate former governor of Massachusetts, who they would disparage 4 years later, was an acceptable alternative as long as I was in the race. We feared that as long as Mitt stuck with his disciplined message on the economy and emphasized his business skills, the race would stay too close for comfort. Our last debate, just 5 days before the primary, had focused on economic policy, and Mitt was far outspending us on television and radio ads. I needed to change the subject. Our research guys dug up a quote by Mitt about Iraq, which, interpreted very literally, could be portrayed as advocating a schedule for withdrawing our troops based on dates rather than conditions on the ground. I accused him of wanting to cut and run before victory was achieved. It was a stretch, according to the fact-checkers, and I caught flack for it. I don't think we took any more liberties with the quote than Mitt had taken with my jobs remark or my immigration views, but the attack angered him, and he wouldn't let it go for 3 days, which played to my advantage since it kept the debate focused on Iraq and not the economy. I knew from personal experience how he felt. I'd gotten angry over attacks in South Carolina 8 years before and strayed from my reform message to air my grievances. Mitt called our tactics in Florida Nixonian, but he kept talking about them, which is probably a reaction that would have pleased Richard Nixon. He had a point, though, and as I said, getting pissed off by an opponent's attack is something I could relate to empathetically. But the comeback phase of my campaign was over. I had made my point about the surge and proved that I was resilient. Now I was running to win the thing. An endorsement by Charlie Crist, Florida's Republican governor, the night before the primary gave us a last burst of speed across the finish line. According to Rudy, Crist had promised his endorsement to him. Mitt thought he had received encouragement, too. Rudy was angered by the betrayal, but not at me. He knew his candidacy was finished. That night, he and I talked on the phone, and our staffs conferred about working together after Florida. I won the Florida primary by a little more than I thought we would, 5 points, and with it, all 57 of its delegates. Mitt wasn't going anywhere yet, but I would be hard to stop now. Super Tuesday, with its 21 primaries and caucuses, and California, the biggest prize, was a week away. Rudy endorsed me the day after the Florida primary and helped us get his supporter, Texas Governor Rick Perry's endorsement the same day that California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger endorsed me, giving our campaign the appearance of the train to ride as it was leaving the station. We had a debate that night at the Reagan Library with Nancy Reagan in attendance. All the remaining candidates were tired and aware that the contest would soon be over. It might have been a comparatively sedate event, but Mitt and I mixed it up anyway, too heatedly, irritability being fatigue's main effect on me. We were in Phoenix for Super Tuesday. Arizona held its primary that day. I won my home state and 8 other primaries, including the biggest ones, California and New York, as well as Illinois, New Jersey, Missouri, and others. Mitt won 7 primaries and caucuses, and Mike Huckabee won 5 Southern contests that night. But my delegate take was 3 times the size of Mitt's and 4 times larger than Huckabee's. I was the presumptive nominee. 2 days later, in a speech in Washington, Mitt ended his campaign. He endorsed me a week after that. Our antagonism quickly cooled as our competitive natures found other outlets and developed into a genuine friendship, which I'm privileged to say continues to this day. He was an effective surrogate in the general election, who never refused his help. I enjoyed reciprocating in 2012, endorsing him before the New Hampshire primary. Huckabee remained in the race, as did Libertarian Ron Paul. Huckabee won a few more Southern contests, but formally withdrew in March after I had accumulated enough delegates to secure the nomination. Paul stayed in until June, when he suspended his campaign, having never won a single primary or caucus, but having made a point of some kind to his passionate followers. I had the advantage of being able to prepare for the general election while Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were still in a dogfight. Hillary was proving to be a tough, resilient competitor. But Obama had something special going on. His crowds were enormous. His appeal for a campaign that aspired to be more than the usual smash-and-grab tactics tapped into a yearning in people alienated from contemporary politics. Much of the press was infatuated with him. I didn't underestimate him. I was impressed by him, and I knew I would be the underdog in the race were he to be my opponent. I had to present myself as a different kind of politician, too, if I was to have a fighting chance, and I had to start right away. I received President Bush's endorsement at the White House the day after Mike Huckabee had withdrawn. I appreciated it and the gracious consideration that he extended me throughout the campaign. The president's approval rating was at its lowest due to the widespread unhappiness with the Iraq War and the federal response to Hurricane Katrina. To state the obvious, the image conveyed by his endorsement wasn't likely to reinforce the idea that I was a different kind of Republican. Rather, It would be interpreted as a ritual anointing of an heir apparent to a then unpopular president, an interpretation Democrats were quick to publicize. Neither did the trip to Iraq I took later that month with Lindsey Graham and Joe Lieberman have the appearance of change either. The progress we had made there since our last trip was noticeable and encouraging, and I said so, which might have sounded to many voters as the same old empty assurances they'd been hearing for 5 years. I had been a U.S. senator for over 20 years and a nationally known politician for almost a decade. But while Obama and Clinton were slugging it out and consuming most of the public's appetite for politics, my advisors thought I should reintroduce myself to voters who might still be paying attention. We decided I would give several speeches in locations that had been important in my life. The subjects of each speech would be mostly biographical, emphasizing my service to the nation. We started at Episcopal High School. The Naval Academy was the second stop. By the third speech in Pensacola, where I had trained as a naval aviator, I started getting bored with the story. I expect voters were, too, and likely returned their attention to the close race for the Democratic nomination, while I regaled a few more audiences with favorite tales from my colorful past. I was more enthusiastic about the series of campaign stops that followed my biography tour. Most were in hard-pressed communities that wouldn't vote for me, places that hadn't shared in the prosperity of the previous quarter century. We went to a shuttered steel mill in Youngstown, Ohio, a coal mining hollow in eastern Kentucky, and to New Orleans' Ninth Ward. We began the tour in Alabama's Black Belt, named for the richness of its soil. It's a mostly rural, economically distressed section of the state, where the majority of voters are African American and Democrat. It was a politically inhospitable section of a state that would vote overwhelmingly for the Republican nominee for president, whether he campaigned there or not. Campaigning anywhere in Alabama wouldn't gain or cost a single vote. But that was sort of the point. I wanted to stress that ours wasn't like Republican campaigns of the past. I wasn't interested in sharpening old divisions, emphasizing partisan differences, and trying to run up the score with the base without scaring off too many moderates and independents. I wanted to show I cared about every American community, that all Americans are my responsibility, and would be my concern were I to become their president. We kicked off the tour on an April morning in Selma, Alabama, at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where 43 years earlier, Alabama state troopers and local police had savagely beaten peaceful civil rights marchers, men, women, and children, including John Lewis, a man I greatly admired. "There must be no forgotten places in America," I said to the 150 or so Selma residents who gathered to listen. "Whether they have been ignored for long years by the sins of indifference and injustice, or have been left behind as the world grew smaller and more economically interdependent." I recounted John Lewis's story, how he had bravely stood to take the expected blows from the troopers' batons and collapsed unconscious in his blood-stained raincoat. "In America, we have always believed that if the day was a disappointment, we would win tomorrow. That's what John Lewis believed when he marched across this bridge." The audience was mostly white. Selma is mostly black. After my remarks, reporters were quick to point out the difference, as if I hadn't been aware of it myself. "I'm aware the African-American vote has been very small in favor of the Republican Party," I responded. "I am aware of the challenges, and I am aware of the fact that there will be many people who will not vote for me, but I'm going to be the president of all the people." We traveled from Selma to other stops in the Black Belt, Camden and Thomasville, where I held a town hall at a packed junior college auditorium, and to G's Bend on the Alabama River, where lived a remote but somewhat famous community of quilters whose work had been nationally and internationally recognized. There I received what is probably the most effusive reception I have ever received in my political career. The women of G's Bend all turned out to welcome us as our bus pulled to a stop. They shouted, sang, and danced and tried to get me to dance, as ungainly a sight as any they had seen before as they escorted Cindy and me around their little community and to see and admire their quilts. They recalled how the local ferry service had been terminated in 1962 to prevent them from crossing the river to register to vote in the county seat. It hadn't stopped them. The ferry wouldn't be restored until 2006. They thanked us for coming and wished us good luck in the election. And they meant it, even though they were surely going to vote for my opponent. They were the warmest and most genuine people I've ever met. I loved it the entire day. It remains one of my fondest memories of the campaign and in all of my public life. Noted in many of the news accounts of the day's events was the fact that I was a rare Republican politician in those parts. I loved that. The headline for the Birmingham News Report proclaimed, "In Black Belt, McCain wins hearts, not votes." I loved reading that, too. We visited the weathered porch of the Fletcher family's house in Inez, Kentucky, where Lyndon Johnson had announced the war on poverty in 1964, and where the coal industry's decline had sunk the area deeper into the poverty Johnson had promised they would escape. Inez remained one of the poorest communities in Appalachia. I made a brief speech at the Martin County Courthouse before taking questions. I acknowledged that I had been raised in the Navy and had an easier start in life than the families who worked the mines and farms of Appalachia, and my life continued to be easier than theirs. But you are my fellow Americans, and that kinship means more to me than almost any other association. Then I answered questions, joked around, and swapped stories with him for a while, refusing a few invitations to attack Obama, who had lost the Pennsylvania primary the night before, but was still viewed as the likely Democratic nominee. There would come a time soon enough when our campaigns would trade accusations and batter each other. For now, I wanted to do what I was doing, talking with Americans I didn't know and who didn't really know me, and assure them of my concern for their situation. A reporter for The New Yorker described my Inez town hall as a remarkably subdued performance. I didn't mind. I followed the town hall with a fairly lively press conference. The same reporter had also noted that McCain doesn't try to stir the crowd's darker passions or its higher aspirations. He doesn't present himself as a conservative leader. He is simply a leader. Here I am, a man in full. Take me or leave me. This might be the only kind of Republican who could win in 2008. I liked that thought quite a bit, whether it was true or not. We ended the tour walking the streets of New Orleans' Katrina-ravaged Ninth Ward past abandoned homes and huge heaps of debris. Reporters rode in front of us in a flatbed truck, captives for the moment, and unhappy that they couldn't interview the locals as we toured their devastated neighborhood. I promised to expedite the building of a new levee system and restore wetlands that could absorb storm surges. I swore never again would the federal government fail Americans as disgracefully as it had failed the people of New Orleans. We followed the tour with a series of policy speeches on health care, national security, economic policy, the environment, and tax reform. I gave a speech in Columbus, Ohio, that envisioned the progress I hoped to achieve by the end of my first term in office, listing a number of bipartisan accomplishments that included a successful conclusion to the war in Iraq and most of our troops returned home. I wanted to run the kind of substantive campaign the press and public claimed to want while they focused their attention on the horse race. They had quite a race running in the other party, and while we received dutiful attention for my campaign stops and policy speeches, it was usually relegated to the inside pages of the newspaper while the Obama-Clinton contest owned the front page. Then it was over. In the first week of June, on the night of the last Democratic primaries, Obama collected enough delegates to be the presumptive nominee. Hillary conceded and endorsed him a few days later. Turnout in the Democratic contests had set records. Even in some red states, more people had voted for Obama or Clinton than had supported me and the other Republican candidates. Obama looked on top of the world the night he clinched the nomination. He gave a speech that captivated his supporters and most of the press. I made a speech that night, too. I didn't want to concede to him any news cycle from that day on if I could help it. It was a mistake in hindsight. I wasn't going to own even a small share of the attention on the night a young African-American with an exotic name, who had come from obscurity a few years before, captured the hearts and minds of millions of excited voters and won a major political party's presidential nomination. Not much was noted in the press about my speech other than that I had the temerity to distract attention from my opponent's triumph and that I'd spoken in front of a bright green background that looked odd on television. There would be other nights throughout the general election campaign when I would find it difficult, if not impossible, to compete with the publicity and excitement my opponent generated. I had two imperatives before me that were clear from the beginning of my contest with Barack Obama. The first was obvious. I was the more experienced public official, having had a career in the military as well as a career in politics. I had to make the case that experience was still crucially important in choosing a president. My military credential was more of an advantage than my long career in Congress, which wasn't something that thrilled voters in 2008. It hampered my second, more important objective, convincing skeptical voters that I, too, could be counted on to change Washington. The only way I could persuade voters I would bring change as president was to conduct my campaign for the office in ways that were noticeably different from presidential campaigns of the past. But the idea wasn't just tactical. I truly did want to campaign in a way that was more honest and, I hoped, inspiring. And to do that, I needed my opponent to be my partner. I love the story that Jack Kennedy and Barry Goldwater had agreed to travel together on the same plane in 1964 if Barry were to win the Republican nomination, and hold a series of informal debates or dueling speeches in small and large communities across the country. We proposed something along that line to the Obama campaign. We suggested holding 10 joint town hall-style debates and traveling together to each of them. They countered by offering one town hall event on the 4th of July and the three traditional debates the Commission on Presidential Debates had already proposed. They were silent about the plane. That was disappointing. I'm not naive. I had a lot to gain. Obama had a lot to lose. He was the front runner. He had lots more money than we had. He was getting a lot more attention than I was. And he owned the change message. All those advantages might have been risked or at least diminished had he agreed to share the spotlight with his opponent in such a novel way. But I believe then that by our willingness to trust voters' intelligence and decency, and to an extent to trust each other, we would have called out some of the BS in the way politics is routinely practiced and conducted ourselves in a way that we in the country could be proud of. I love the idea. I suspect he saw the appeal of it too. But front-runners are risk-averse. Challengers are risk-takers. And that's how his advisors likely saw the proposal, as an unnecessary risk. Yet his very decision to run had been a risk. I hope some of that daring would have influenced his decisions in the general election campaign, but he decided not to squander his advantages. It was the prudent thing to do. When Nancy Reagan and Lyndon Johnson's daughters invited us to hold joint town halls at the Reagan and Johnson libraries, we agreed. The Obama campaign declined. When we agreed to abide by campaign spending limits in order to receive the millions of dollars in public financing we needed, the Obama campaign, knowing they had an immense financial advantage, announced Obama would be the first nominee to opt out of the public financing system. That was also the prudent thing to do. We expected that the press would support our position on debates and public financing and punish Obama for rejecting them. That turned out to be misjudgment on my part. Most reporters liked the idea of joint town halls and spending limits, but they liked the Obama story better, and the fallout he experienced for rejecting them was negligible. There isn't any way the loser in an election can criticize the press without appearing to be a sore loser, so I won't complain here, not much anyway. Most of the coverage I received was fine. I didn't agree with all of it. I disliked the criticism I received, although I earned some of it. I also understand why my opponent's campaign made such good copy and attracted more attention than ours did. He was new news. I wasn't. and most reporters were more aligned with his politics than mine. Above all, his success seemed to transcend political tribalism and represent real progress against the racism that had afflicted our society from its founding, and reporters, like most people, didn't want to see that progress set back. The press had a finger on the scale for Obama, both in the primaries and the general election. They gave him more favorable attention than they gave his opponents. They defended him from attacks, unfair and fair, and criticized his opponents for making them. I don't think that's disputable or surprising. The favoritism wasn't universal, and it didn't determine the outcome. It was just a challenge we had to factor into our decision-making. I didn't like it. But given the media environment we live in today, where we can restrict information gathering to sources that tell us only what we want to hear, where crackpot conspiracy websites like InfoWars and Breitbart and Russian propagandists such as Russia Today and WikiLeaks are taken more seriously by their credulous followers than journalism practiced with professional standards and ethics, the problem of routine liberal bias in the media seems positively quaint. I'm familiar with how reporters can favor and protect one candidate over another. I had that advantage in the primaries in 2000, and I know it when I see it. It's certainly helpful, but you can't win a presidential election on a better press alone. The irony here is that Obama didn't need it. He was running a hell of a campaign. He had bottled lightning in a political environment that couldn't have been more favorable to the party out of power. He was in accord with the country and the times. He was the biggest political show on earth. His first trip overseas as the Democratic nominee in July generated much more excitement than mine had. He stopped in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as Jordan, Israel, and the West Bank before visiting the capitals of our main European allies. He was greeted effusively, not just by the government leaders he met. His public reception at some of his stops was rapturous. He gave a speech in Berlin that drew a crowd estimated to be as many as 250,000 people. It was a spectacle that led the news broadcasts and dominated the front page. He had something going on, all right, and figuring out how to challenge it and divert a little more interest in our direction was as difficult as it was imperative. Win or lose, I didn't want anyone ever to have fair grounds to criticize us for resorting to any kind of racist dog whistling. I wanted to win, I wanted to be president, but I too recognized the social progress Obama's candidacy represented, and I didn't want to impede it by inciting, even with a wink and a nod here and there, or with language that had double meanings, the prejudices that have marred our history. I cautioned staff repeatedly, and senior staff reiterated it repeatedly, to steer clear of any communication, formal or informal, or an event or any person that could be interpreted as suggesting race as a reason to vote for me and against Obama. That meant our criticism of him and any of his associates had to be carefully screened for a meaning we didn't intend. We were on the receiving end of quite a number of attacks by his campaign and assorted Democratic entities on people working with or associated with us in some way. We had to be more restrained in that line of attack, as we would learn again and again. The press was primed to prosecute any hint of racism. Every now and again, I had to chastise someone introducing me or warming up the crowd or asking me a question for what could be construed as at least an implicit racist remark, emphasizing Obama's middle name, claiming he was a secret Kenyan or Arab or Muslim and somehow disloyal to the country. Questioning his patriotism, his parentage, his travels, and experiences as a young man. The occasional vulgar or cruel or racist shout from the crowd, I condemned them when I heard them. I forbade all mention of the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, Obama's controversial pastor, whose sermons had been the reason Obama felt it necessary to give his much-praised speech on race the previous March. Fred Davis, who led our media team, had prepared an ad that attacked Obama's relationship with Wright. I rejected it. In July, Fred, Rick Davis, and Steve Schmidt proposed a kind of jiu-jitsu ad that used my opponent's strength against him. In this case, the ad used Obama's global celebrity to raise doubts about his preparation for the job of president, and by inference contrasted his experience unfavorably to mine. I thought it was fair play, and still do. It was a 30-second spot with a female narrator over images of his Berlin event and pop culture celebrities of the time, and above the sound of a crowd chanting Obama's name, the narrator intoned, "He's the biggest celebrity in the world, but is he ready to lead?" That was it. The ad took a couple of quick shots at his positions on oil, drilling, and taxes, but they were sort of beside the point. Its purpose was to suggest that his sudden celebrity was not based on real achievements or better ideas. It didn't mention my record, didn't need to. We would do that in our earned media. Our message through that summer had two parts: ready on day one and country first. My war record, Navy career, long involvement with national security issues, long-standing relationships with foreign leaders, and record of bipartisan accomplishments demonstrated more experience than could my opponent, who had been a state senator and briefly a U.S. senator before becoming the biggest celebrity in the world. My support for the surge and other views that weren't always popular with Republican leaders or the conservative base, as well as my conduct as a POW, were presented as proof that I put the country before myself. It was our best case at the time, and it worked. By the end of the month, we had put a dent in Obama's lead. And in August, a few polls, including Gallup's, had me slightly ahead. Everything we did was scrutinized by the other side and the media for any trace of below-the-belt insinuations. That included the celebrity ad. Questions were raised about whether we used Paris Hilton's and Britney Spears' images in the ad to appeal to prejudiced white voters' fear of miscegenation, or if we had darkened Obama's skin in the photograph we used. Silly shit like that was tossed at us regularly. We didn't intend to play those games. We didn't want to play those games. And we didn't play those games. We didn't want to set the country back or undermine the social significance of Obama's candidacy. We took pains to stay clear of that stuff. We denounced anyone who resorted to it. And we were proud we did. Nevertheless, we were frequently accused without evidence of racist insinuations or worse. Newsweek ran a cover story in May that didn't just imply but openly assumed we would make or secretly support racist attacks on my opponent. The Obama campaign and reporters relying on Democratic opposition research regularly assailed members of my campaign staff, my donors, and supporters for their businesses and associations. But we were restrained from doing the same by our own, and the media's insistence that we take extreme care to avoid the appearance of appealing to people's prejudices. Our surrogates were criticized for making fun of Obama's experience as a community organizer, which I sort of regret. There's nothing wrong with, and probably much that's admirable, about the occupation. But our ridicule wasn't racist, as some alleged. We were accused of racism for calling Bill Ayers, my opponent's early supporter and former member of the Weather Underground, a terrorist, despite the fact that he was white and had been involved in bombings at New York City's police headquarters, the Pentagon, and the U.S. Capitol. When the housing market crashed in the fall, and with it much of the global credit system, Democrats fixed the blame on George Bush and his heir apparent, me. That's politics. I would have done the same if I'd been them. When we responded by pointing out that the people who ran Fannie Mae, one of the institutions responsible for the housing market collapse, were all Obama supporters, including its CEO, Franklin Raines, we were accused of invoking race because Raines was black. It was the predicament we had to learn to operate within and not take personally. I didn't like it, of course, at all. But in only one instance did I take lasting offense at a false accusation. Citing reports that fall that racist insults were shouted from the crowd at some of my events, John Lewis, a personal hero of mine, accused our campaign of sowing hatred, compared me to George Wallace, and said that, like Wallace, we were creating the kind of political atmosphere that got four little girls killed in a Birmingham church. I couldn't believe it, and I couldn't forgive it.
I still can't.
My biggest predicament was my difficulty convincing voters I was an agent of change. That was our principal concern as we assembled a list of potential vice presidents that summer. I wanted to choose someone I respected, and I wanted the choice to represent change. We had a list of names with 20 to 30 people. The lawyers vetting candidates for us, led by the able A.B. Culverhouse, a prominent Washington attorney, did a public record search for all of them, and several were removed from the list. I admit I didn't give the attention they deserved to all the prospects who remained on the list. I gave most thought to people with whom I had an established relationship. I thought a lot about choosing Mitt Romney. He had been my most formidable opponent in the primaries and is a smart, capable, and appealing candidate with expertise in issues where I was a little deficient. Tim Pawlenty was another successful blue state governor I got along with well. Mike Bloomberg, a brilliant businessman and innovative mayor, was on the list too. All the choices had some downside. Had I asked Governor Romney to join the ticket, the Democrats would have greeted the decision by reminding voters of the attacks and recriminations we had exchanged during the primaries. That's standard practice when the nominee asks a rival to join the ticket. It's annoying, but it's fair, and it's a surmountable problem. Tim Pawlenty didn't have much national name identification, which was fine. He would have been a fresh face. He had widespread appeal in Minnesota, and I liked him and his wife, Mary, a lot. He would be viewed as a safe, conventional choice, solid on the merits, but not an outsider or a credible change agent. Mike Bloomberg, a friend, would be viewed as a change. He had an impressive record of accomplishment in New York, but one not always admired by conservatives, nor were his views on guns, abortion, and other social issues. Conservatives didn't consider Mike to be a moderate Republican or Rhino, Republican in name only, an epithet often hurled at me. They viewed him as a liberal, along the lines of John Lindsay, a species of Republican that hasn't existed in any numbers for quite a while. They viewed his affiliation with the Republican Party as weak and opportunistic. Mike is smart, shrewd, and not given to posturing. When we informed him he was on the short list and asked if he would agree to be fully vetted, he responded with, "Are you sure about this?" I had met with several prospects under consideration and read vetting summaries for others. In May, I had invited a few of them to our place in northern Arizona for the weekend in the hope that a relaxed social setting among our family and friends would give me a better sense of their personalities. I didn't like the idea of conducting formal interviews, and I left routine issue and background questions to the lawyers and staff. I did want to know, if I didn't already, what issues were their priorities, and I wanted to be confident that they would share mine. I admired many of the candidates, and I enjoyed the company of most of them. By late June, I had mentally culled a shorter list from the short list, consisting of 3 or 4 names. Each had appeal, and I liked them all, but I kept coming back to one name that would have certainly represented change, although that wasn't the principal reason I wanted to pick him. Joe Lieberman and I shared the same worldview and concerns, and we were the best of friends. I trusted him completely and valued his counsel. He was no longer formally a Democrat, having won his last re-election as an independent. But he caucused with Senate Democrats, and he had been the Democratic vice presidential nominee in 2000. He had endorsed me in December when I wasn't the presumptive nominee or the favorite to win, when there was no advantage for him to risk his relationships with Democrats. Were Joe to join the ticket, it would send a clear message of change. It would be an emphatic statement that I intended to govern collaboratively, with an emphasis on problem-solving, not politics, which in 2008 would have been very good politics. The more I thought about asking Joe, the more the idea felt right to me. By the end of July, I had decided I would ask Joe to join what I hoped would be seen as a national unity ticket pledged to avoid partisan excesses in the hope of overcoming Washington gridlock. I shared the decision with my closest advisors, including Lindsey Graham, who enthusiastically endorsed the idea. We agreed to keep my decision a closely held secret while Rick Davis and others began gauging how difficult it would be to get convention delegates to vote for a vice presidential nominee whose views on various social issues, including abortion, were to the left of mine and far to the left of most of the delegates. Of course, as soon as they began raising the idea with state and national party leaders, speculation ensued about who McCain's pro-choice pick might be, which in turn aroused the conservative base and brought private and public recriminations from a broad array of Republicans, some of whose opinions I valued and some I didn't. Their argument was that a pro-choice pick, whoever it was, might survive the convention but would fatally divide the Republican Party. The reality of Republican politics set in. Even were Joe to give assurances that he would be duty-bound to uphold my positions on all issues were he to assume the presidency, it wouldn't stop the intra-party brawl that would be the only story coming out of the Republican convention and would dominate coverage of our campaign in the critical first weeks of the fall campaign. With the exception of Lindsay, who remained supportive, everyone else I had entrusted with my decision advised me against it. They had liked the idea initially and thought we could still get Joe through the convention, barely. But they thought we would discourage activists and depress Republican turnout more than we would attract independents and cross over Democrats. I didn't agree with the advice, or more accurately, I didn't like the advice, and I continued to insist on naming Joe my running mate, while the window for making and preparing for another choice was rapidly closing. They were giving me their best counsel. It was sound advice that I could reason for myself, but my gut told me to ignore it, and I wish I had. America's security and standing in the world were my principal concerns and the main reason, other than personal ambition, that I ran for president. Joe and I share those priorities, and on most related issues we agree on how best to serve them. I completely trusted, liked, and worked well with Joe, and I still believe, whatever the effect it would have had in some quarters of the party, that a McCain-Lieberman ticket would have been received by most Americans as a genuine effort to pull the country together for a change. I don't like not doing what I know in my gut I should do. I made it known that I reluctantly accepted my advisor's concerns. Then I sulked about it for a little while. We were nearly out of time. The Republican convention was a week away, and when Steve Schmidt and Rick Davis raised Sarah Palin with me, I was intrigued. Steve had spent time in Alaska on business in recent months and had been impressed by what he had learned about her. Rick had reviewed what research was immediately available and watched recordings of some of her press interviews. He was impressed as well. Sarah had been among the names on the initial longer list of VP prospects, most of whom had received a cursory public document vetting before being dropped for other more serious prospects. I had met her briefly at a recent National Governors Association meeting in Washington and had been seated at her table at a dinner that night. I had liked her. She had spirit and charisma. She had been governor less than 2 years, but her involvement in state politics had begun a decade and a half before, and she had been active in the local politics of the town where she'd been mayor, Wasilla, since the early 1990s. She was a popular, energetic, and accomplished reformer as mayor, governor, and as a campaigner. She had been appointed by her predecessor, Frank Murkowski, to the state's Oil and Gas Commission. Her lack of experience with energy issues hadn't prevented her from recognizing and criticizing ethical breaches committed by a fellow commissioner and other public officials who had conflicts of interest involving oil and gas companies. She had cooperated with a Democratic legislator to make the case for their removal from office. She ran for governor on an ethics reform platform against the incumbent and most influential Republican in Alaska for the nomination. She beat a former Democratic governor in the general. The underestimated small-town mayor was an underdog and vastly outspent in both races, but she had won. As governor, she passed an ethics reform bill her first year in office and raised taxes on the biggest interest in Alaska, the oil and gas industry, and used the revenues to offset the high fuel prices Alaskans were paying at the time. Her profile as a reformer and as someone who managed to get important stuff done without years of experience or deferring to established interests was her main appeal. The fact that she was an accomplished woman succeeding in a male-dominated profession didn't hurt either. We felt, and polling confirmed, that there were moderate and conservative Democrats who had voted for Hillary Clinton and might be persuaded to vote for a Republican presidential candidate with a record of working with both sides and the female chief executive he had picked as his running mate. On several issues, Sarah held more conservative positions than mine, from drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to public funding for stem cell research. As my running mate, she would be expected to defer to my views, and she did. But the expectation she would excite conservatives who hadn't reconciled themselves to my nomination and were at present unlikely to work hard to turn out Republican voters was a consideration, too. Not the main one, but not a negligible one. Her reformer credentials, the surprise her selection would be, her gender, and her naturalness as a political personality were what made her so appealing to us. I called her and asked if she would agree to a formal vetting and to come to Arizona to meet with me. Although she had to have been surprised by the call, she answered affirmatively, very calmly, as if she'd been expecting the call. I told her we would be in touch shortly with the details, and she thanked me for calling. The experience reminded me a little of the time I'd received a call from Bob Dole during the 1996 Republican convention asking me if I would mind putting his name in formal nomination the next night, offering me a prime-time speech a little more than 24 hours before it had to be delivered. That's quite an honor, an opportunity for a junior senator, and Bob had made the offer with all the ceremony of someone asking me the time. I had just dangled before Sarah Palin an opportunity to become overnight a nationally known figure, with all that means, good and bad. She had responded as if it had been a routine request, and she was open to the idea. A few days later, Sarah and an aide flew to Flagstaff, where she interviewed first with Schmidt and Salter, and then with A.B. Culverhouse and his team. If after their conversations, they and Rick Davis agreed she was the wrong pick, they would thank her for her time and arrange for her flight back to Alaska. But if they felt it was worthwhile for me to meet with her, they would bring her to our place an hour from Flagstaff. She arrived the next day after spending all night on the phone with the lawyers. We sat next to the creek and talked for an hour. I liked her right away. She spoke with genuine passion about government reform and fighting corruption. She acknowledged our differences, but noted that we shared an independent streak that put the country above party. She is uncannily self-possessed and has an authentic warmth as a campaigner. I sensed how appealing a performer she would be, and her self-confidence allayed concerns we had that she might not be able to withstand the scrutiny and rigors of a presidential campaign. I walked away from our meeting confident that she could. Whatever stumbles she would have in the blindingly intense experience she was about to enter would be on us, on our judgment, not hers. Cindy sat with Sarah after we finished our conversation and showed her around the place while I talked with Salter and Schmidt. I'd spoken to A.B. earlier, who counseled that she would be a high-risk, high-reward pick. He saw her appeal and potential and the vulnerabilities that could be exposed by the battering of a national campaign that can test the fortitude of more experienced politicians. Salter worried that Sarah's scant exposure to national politics and her self-admitted knowledge deficiency in national security issues would undermine the experience advantage we had over Obama. He argued for Tim Pawlenty. Schmidt made the case for her, which essentially boiled down to she could shake up the race and the other candidates can't. She was a fresh face, an outspoken reformer, a wife and mother who had fought the special interests and won. She could appeal to conservative Democrats and women voters not yet sold on Obama or me. She was tough and could handle pressure. She was smart, hard-working, and willing to learn. We had three opportunities, he argued, to stop the race from trending inevitably to the challenger in an environment where over 70% of voters believe the country was going in the wrong direction. My vice president selection, my convention speech, and the debates. If we failed to use any one of those opportunities to convince voters we would bring change to Washington, we would lose. Sarah was the biggest change message on the list of possible choices, I thought Schmidt made the better argument, probably because it echoed my own thoughts about Sarah and the challenges ahead. I walked back to the deck of our house where Cindy and Sarah were sitting and offered her the nomination. We talked a while longer, then she left with Salter and Schmidt to fly to Dayton, Ohio,